Blog Talk Radio.
Up the Story Blender, of course, hosted by Stephen James, and Susan May Warren is his new co-host, so you'll be hearing her tonight. Tonight's guest is going to be Kim Whitecamp. She is an internationally known storyteller at the root of all she does. She is first and foremost a storyteller, performing internationally at festival theaters and providing keynotes for some of the Forbes and most recognized companies. So very interesting that we were going to be able to listen to her tonight. So without any further ado, let's jump right on in here to tonight's edition of the Story Blender with very special guest, Kim Whitecamp. Hope you enjoy, everybody.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Susan May Warren.
And I'm Stephen James.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. So I'm so excited about today's guest. She's a professional speaker, a performance storyteller, and a communications consultant. And at the root of all she does, Kim Whitecamp is first and foremost a storyteller. So Kim's stories have appeared in Sirius Satellite Radio and NPR. She performs internationally at festivals and theaters. She keynotes for some of Forbes' most recognized companies, boasts a mantle full of awards, and constantly writes creative new material. She also records and produces award-winning albums. So she's got a wealth of insight to bring to us on the craft of shaping great stories, and we're so excited to have her. Thanks, Kim, for being here today.
Well, I'm happy to be here. It's good to talk to you both.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So most of our listeners are authors and readers, but they might not be familiar with the oral storytelling revival. Can you tell us a little bit about how you became involved with storytelling?
Sure. Well, for about 23 years, I worked with adjudicated and at-risk youth as well as just youth in general, but with a specialty in that. And I used story a lot to help address issues that they had.
Mm.
And But story has been a huge part of my life, my whole life. I mean, even as a kid, I have report cards that say, if Kim would just not talk so much, if she'd stop telling stories, if she'd stop trying to, my third grade teacher, Mrs. Wyrick, said, if Kim would entertain her work as much as she tries to entertain the class. And you understand, that's like my first official review of my work, and the word tries. was put
That's
in there.
Great.
It was devastating. So, I've always had a love of story, and I've always written, and I realized that story worked whenever you were working within a kind of counseling or leading way with people.
Yeah.
And after doing that for about 23 years, I took a 2-year break, and I realized, to kind of redirect my life and decide, the next season. And the thing that I realized I couldn't live without was stories. So here I am.
Huh. That is very cool. Now you are an oral storyteller. And is this, I know Steve and I were talking before we got on, and we were talking about how, storytelling and being a comedian are similar because you're up there in front of an audience. A comedian has to sort of react to the audience. I suppose a storyteller does as well. Can you tell us a little bit about, how that works, in terms of how you tell a story, and then, how is that different from being a comedian, and, are they similar? Could you tell us, just help us relate to what it's like to be a storyteller.
Okay, well, there's some really marked differences between comedians and storytellers. I get paid a contracted fee, stay in a hotel, and get really nice meals, and my travel paid. Comedians
nice.
Get a beer and a burger and a split of the door. So right there
That's
is
fantastic.
Your first reason to not.
Yes.
But there is also a huge difference in our content, obviously. storytelling, when I perform from stages, I'm billed normally as a humorist, spoken word artist, singer, songwriter, author, blah, 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 blah. You know, that's when I'm entertaining. There's like a line of things and they can use what they want. But my job is to make people do three things: to think, to feel, and to laugh. And I know laughter can be put in and mixed in there, but I take humor so seriously and in how I use it to open up people, to bring down defenses so that then I can come in with the kind of the meat and the heart of my pieces. They're so open and embracing to it by the time I get there. I really use humor almost as a tool, as a dentist would to prep. And afterwards, people, you know, after a comedian performs, because I've seen, I actually have a list, a bucket list of comedians, and I've seen a lot of comedians that I love. But after the show, people aren't crying and hugging them and saying, I've got to tell you about my grandmother. Or they're not laughing and embracing them and going, I've got to tell you about the bike I had as a kid. You know, you so much more personable and personal. And comedians, and I love comedians, because and I do use comedy in my stuff, humor, but they kind of take the world in and regurgitate it in a very almost sarcastic way, where they're making fun, and that isn't at all what I do at all.
Right.
There's, you know, it's very different. In comedy, when a comedian's on stage, people don't die, right? Whereas in my people, there are people who actually die, you know. So it's very, very different. Very different.
Now, Kim,
I love how you
a little bit. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Stephen. That's great.
No, I was
Susan,
just going to
say, you love me.
A little bit about.
I did. I said, I love you. No, I said, I love that, but I love you too.
It didn't take long.
No.
But I was just going to say, Kim, tell us a little bit about how you develop humor. I mean, what do you see as sort of the core ingredient to help people to do that, to laugh, to warm up to you as you perform and speak and tell stories?
Well, you know, there's so many different kinds of storytellers, and I am a little different in that I'm not niched in the realm that I walk in. You know, there are people that do only tall tales, and then there are people that only do folk tales, and then there are people that only do, we call them cracked, fractured fairy tales. They're more adult. And then there are people who do historical things, you know, and I tend to walk in so many different areas, so I can only talk about what I'm familiar with. But when I'm working on a piece, a story, as that's what it is, but when I'm working on a piece, I am very careful and exact with my humor. Because when I walk out, you know, with a comedian, they walk out and people have a blank slate, but they are totally judging. And within the first minute, maybe up to three, if you got to get to three, something's wrong anyways. But within the first minute, they know whether they like you, your movements, your look, your voice, your style, and how you're delivering the material. In that way, we're very similar. Because when I walk out on stage, for instance, last night I did a gig at a resort. I'm there for a couple months, actually. And the audience changes every show. And there's about 350 people. And they have no clue who I am. Now, granted, there were people there that heard I was performing there, so they come, and it's wonderful because they're supporters, right? They're fans, whatever you want to call them. I don't like the word fan. It's just kind of weird. But supporters. And but overall, they don't know me. And within the first minute to up to 3 minutes, people are instantly analyzing whether or not they're going to like me or not. And there are some people in the storytelling world that say, well, it's not about the storyteller, it's about the story. If the story's good, it doesn't matter about the storyteller. Well, in my world, it does, because these people paid a ticket price. And they're coming to see someone perform a story. This isn't around a campfire or a dinner table. They have paid to be entertained. So, yes, it does matter. And one of the ways that I, in that first 3 minutes, get them to where they're open to me is self-deprecating humor. And I turn it on me. I'm never mean to the audience,
right?
Ever, because of where I'm going to take them. I can't be. Someone is not going to allow you to cut into their soul if you've just cut them down.
Right.
And comedy tends to cut people down. There's some stellar comedians who don't do that, and I think it's a lot harder work. It's easy to be mean and have everyone laugh at you while you're bullying somebody. But in my case, I can't cut them down because I'm going to cut into a deep part of them. For instance, one of the pieces I did last night was called The Lap. And so it's I start out about being a middle-aged woman, about finding myself single at almost 50. And I know it's hard to believe I'm that old if you've seen my picture, but I am. And that was supposed to be like a self-giving compliment. And and so I make fun of myself, and people are shaking their heads up and down. All around me, men are shaking their heads up and down about menopause. Yes, we understand, you know. And I've got them there. They're like, okay, we're all cool. And then I move into the piece, which goes into some really deep stuff. And by then, they're ready to take it. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
So, in other words, you make them relate to you where they think, oh, yeah, I understand this person. I'm on the same level as them. And then you bring them into that, you know, now they've joined with you on the journey, and you bring them into the story in a way that they have the same viewpoint or the same perspective almost as you do.
Yeah, and it might not be the same viewpoint because, you know, I'm standing up there as an almost 50-year-old woman who travels full-time, and I may be speaking to an engineer who's 34 and sits behind a desk all day. So what I'm dropping, we're all viewing it from a different point, but they feel safe to approach it because I have now said, look, we're all in the same boat together. We've laughed together. I've made you recognize some things in me that are in you, whether it be midlife crisis, identity crisis, whatever, funny stuff, just, you know, funny, And so then they are very safe to approach and open themselves up to the deeper parts of what I'm about to bring them, which I do, because I'm a storyteller, not a comedian.
That's great. I love
Although
how you...
for the right price, I could be a comedian. You know, whatever you pay me for, I can do it. I mean, and I've had few shows where I'm like, okay, these people have no clue what a storyteller is. They're here to laugh. I've got them for 20 minutes, and I completely boil everything into one pot, and it is just like bam, 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 bam. And it is kind of stand-up because I have to survive that moment. Luckily, I've gotten to a point in my career where that doesn't happen often, and I have ticketed, seated theater-type audiences, so that's cool.
Right. So very much do you react to the audience and as you're moving through, or do you sort of have a set story that you're going to tell? And, I mean, how much does the audience reaction play into your storytelling, you know, performance?
Huge, huge. Actually, I never know what I'm going to tell. So I'm getting ready to go on stage. For instance, last night, I was behind in the little green room area. I looked out. I assessed the audience. What age am I looking at here? Are there any kids? And they're very seldom is. But there were just a few that were brought in, maybe three. I think there was like three out of the whole audience. And I looked at the age. I looked at female to male ratio, you know, just kind of got a gauge. And then I was in my head like, okay, these pieces would work. It's 8 o'clock show. You know, they've just had their dinner. I need to keep them awake. All these things play into this. You know, where am I telling? I'm telling it at a resort. They have no clue what it is I do. They think they have an idea. The word humorous kind of brought them in the door probably. And so then I am formulating, and that happens everywhere I go. I'm in Wisconsin this weekend. They wanted me to send them my set list. I'm like, that is impossible. How do I know who the heck is going to be in the crowd? I pick my pieces out of my brain according to the audience and where I'm at, everything. Just once I see the town, it can make a difference. I read the newspaper when I arrive at places, the local newspaper, and I make decisions out of that as well. And and then I get up. And so then during my sets, I definitely play with the audience. There is no fourth wall in storytelling. It's beautiful. Last night, it was so freaking perfect because you could just pay for these moments. But I was talking about trading and how much I love to trade. And I'm like, I got stuff in my purse if you want to trade after the show. And I'm like, I just traded one husband for another. And the whole place, before they could take a breath to laugh, this little kid just howls with laughter. And you know, they totally didn't even get what I was talking about, which made the audience go to a whole other level. So then I specifically turned to that family and just had so much fun for about a minute and a half with this back and forth, and the audience loved it, and it was natural and lovely and cute, and then I went right back into my piece. So that's one of the lovely things about storytelling is it's a totally interactive art form with the audience.
So you really have to be on your toes as a storyteller, not just to have a repertoire of great stories to pull from, but just to be able to interact, you know, on the spur of the moment like that with the audience. So that must be, you know, obviously that's a skill that you've developed. Is that something that you always had? And then what other skills do storytellers need to have that make them into great storytellers?
Well, you know, I have to say that in that area, I'm very fortunate that I've been like that my whole life. My mom, even when I was a kid, would say, if you give her a microphone, you know, just put her in front of a microphone. I love the more people, the better, you know.
Yeah.
People say, you know, I mean, I've done 5,000, 7,000 seat audiences. And they're like, doesn't that make you nervous? And I'm like, heck no. The more, the merrier. Now, I've got two people in a show, which thank goodness hasn't happened in the last 6 years. But in the beginning, you're like, please let two people come. But that's not the case anymore, thank goodness. But I totally lost my train of thought, and I hope this gets edited. hold on.
Yeah. No worries.
Okay. Where were we?
We were talking about spur of the moment speaking. Give her a microphone.
Thank you. Okay, yeah. But I do feed off of the larger crowd. I'm not saying I have to have that, but the bigger the crowd, the better. I mean, when I'm in front of anything like, I'm going to say 400 or 500 and up, even into the thousands, man, I am like in some other spiritual realm, and there are things coming out of my mouth that I never intended, and it's funnier and quicker and sharper. It's just, you know, I guess I feed off of people generally, though. Like, even if I'm at the grocery store, I'm totally interacting with people. I feed off of people. The flip side of that is I have to have complete solitude and alone times because I get completely spent. It's really weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's like all out with people, and then it's complete solitude for it's really weird. But I actually, it's not that weird because a lot of comedians and performers tend to be that way. So, and other storytellers that I travel with were like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kim, you know, as you were talking, I could see so much. I used to do more traveling and speaking before I started writing more full-time and doing storytelling shows. And I was like, exactly, I completely could identify with all of that stuff. And, you know, getting on stage and being like, oh, screw it, I'm not doing that because that's not going to work, with this group of people. You have to read them. And, I mean, one of the things that comes up here over and over is just this idea of really understanding and connecting with your audience, whether it is you're writing a story, telling a story, doing comedy routine, whatever. It's so key to be able to understand and then connect with that audience. And I like how you use humor to kind of break down walls and then help people think about, you know, universal truths. That's great.
And it is different. I mean, my pieces are stories. They are written. I'm a writer. I'm the special guest on a writer's cruise coming up. I mean, I am a writer. But when I sit down with a book like I just did today and already I'm like, ugh. But anyway, we won't get into that. I'm just like 3 pages in. I'm like, I already don't like this. But, you know, when I sit down with a book, I'm not judging the author or the teller. I'm judging the story, which is a reflection of the writer slash teller. But I'm really judging the story. But I don't know, unless there's a jacket flap, what they look like, how they walk, what their voice is like. Whereas as a storyteller, even if my stories are completely stellar and well-written, delivery, voice texture, my clothing, everything is judged with it. And that's the difference between oral and written. You know, if the story's good, that's great. The trouble is, as an oral teller, people are judging everything they're seeing, not just the story, even if it's amazing. And I'm going to tell you, I've seen it happen. There's one time in particular that rings out in my brain right now. A phenomenal teller, great stories, but the delivery lacked. She was completely judged. I could see it the minute she hit stage. Immediately, the audience shifted and closed up just by how she looked. And I just saw it go, and the story didn't matter. So there's a difference there because nobody looks. Now, people will buy a book, I think, sometimes because they like what they're seeing, the graphics, the title, the description. And if the author, like Stephen, is disgustingly handsome, it will.
So true.
I had to break the ice there. I was getting really serious. But if it does make a little difference, if they're like, this guy looks like I can hang out with this guy and have a beer and read this book, you know, I do think it matters, but not near the judgment of an oral teller. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Right. That is really interesting. Go ahead, Stephen.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, I really loved what you were talking about as far as writing the stories that you do and shaping and crafting them. And I know that you have different ways and models that you do use, you know, when you do seminars, workshops, and you teach people about shaping material. Could you take us through any of those here today, or at least some of the core steps that you see for developing a story, whether it might be a written story or a performed story that you're developing new material for?
Oh, gee whiz. You're lucky. I usually charge for this stuff. Okay. So I'm actually writing a book right now. So I'm pretty stoked about that. But I'm going to talk to you more about the written stories that I write for my performance pieces. And I do want to explain something, that there's a difference when you're an entertainer storyteller. Everybody is a storyteller. When someone talks to their daughter before walking down the aisle, the sisters that talk to each other on the phone, they're telling stories, right? People in leadership, they tell stories. Everybody's a storyteller in some right. But when you are a storyteller that is being paid to entertain, it's a different realm. And there are a lot of people that want to get into oral telling, and they think immediately they can jump on stage and that is the end-all, be-all. And I just want to say it is not the end-all, be-all. My friend Les is in Richmond. He is a wonderful storyteller, but he uses his stories in therapy. Could he engage a 1,000-seat audience? I don't know. But that doesn't mean he's less than in his storytelling. And I just wanted to say that real quick. So anyways, the process, it's really weird what happens to me. Sometimes I'll just get the first sentence of a story, and that is it, and it's all I need, and I am off and running. And, you know, as well as I do as a writer, the first sentences can really make or break things. It sets the motion, I think, for a lot of the rest of how the reader or the listener moves forward. And sometimes I'll just see something beautiful or read one line. I read a line in the Foxfire books called, and it just said sourwood honey, and bam, I mean, it was a simple Saturday morning, and those two words, sourwood honey, set off a whole song that I wrote, because I'm also a songwriter, which that's just, you know, story put to music. And I wrote a whole song in 20 minutes, and now there's a whole piece that precedes it, a whole story that precedes it from two words in a Foxfire book. I don't know if you know what they are. And, you know, I did a folk operetta. I wrote a folk operetta. I've never written a folk operetta. And that came out of, I was getting a pedicure, and the woman said something, and it just hung in me like a weight. Like just like a weight, it hung there. And I created over 2 years in my head, which is really bizarre, all of these characters, this whole world, this whole scenario, this whole plot. And then finally I sat down and jotted out the outline really heavy. And that's all I needed to do, because I lived with these people for 2 years. And then I got up and performed it in front of 800 people, and it just won an award. So I know that's very unusual. One of the things I've found with oral tellers is a lot of us don't write things down. We write a lot. We write a lot. Most of us write every single day. But a lot of the pieces we perform, we jot out outlines, and that's all we want, because it's all living in our head, and then it comes out of our mouth, and the editing happens with our audiences. My audiences are my coaches. I have a new piece. It's about a kid named Chubb. Chubb was so cool. And anyway, so I wrote this piece in my head, jotted down a loose outline, shot the piece out when I was doing a residency at a theater in Tennessee, in Jonesboro, and the audience loved the piece, but I could tell by their shiftings, by their movings, by their physical body language, by their laughter, by their non-laughter, where I needed to edit. And now it's just cruising along, that piece, and I've never fully written it down, but I have files and files of things I've written. Does this make any sense? It's really weird.
No, it's fascinating, actually. It's, you know, I'm thinking to myself, you know, I do a lot of speaking, public speaking at women's events and this sort of thing, and I'm thinking, wow, I can't imagine not writing the story down, although in some ways, you know, it comes out different every time, I suppose, if you mm-hmm. would, you know, if you don't write it down, it comes out. I suppose you kind of feel the audience, and then it sort of just comes out. So I think that's really interesting. I haven't thought about not writing. I used to write it out word for word, and then I realized, well, that wasn't helpful because it always changed. Mm-hmm. And so you just sort of write down the big pieces and so that you know it, and then you just tell the story. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. The folk opera that I wrote is an hour and a half long. It has 7 songs in it that I wrote, one of them, two of them with my friend Michael Reno. And that story lived in my head for 2 years, and I tweaked and edited and cut and pasted and rearranged. And these people, I mean, I could actually tell you what Ronnie Callaway smells like. I know it's bizarre. I mean, I lived with them. And then
wow.
I turned that out of my brain into 16 post-it notes on a wall, and then I did the show. I was either really creative and confident or really a stupid idiot. They were taking me in the golf cart down to the tent that was filled with 800 people, I was like, you are an idiot. What have you done? You're going to tell this? And it just flowed right out because it lived in my, it lived deep in me for a long time.
So I want to touch back on that Jonesboro a bit that you talked about. You're in theater there, but that's the storytelling capital of the world. And have you performed at the annual storytelling festival? They have one every October. Have you been there for that?
Yeah,
That
couple years, actually.
Wow, okay. See, now I love that. I used to live in Elizabethton, and Stephen actually lives near. You live in Johnson City, I think. And so we've both attended that festival, and it's a fantastic event. Are you going to be there? I think you're going to make another appearance maybe this year there?
Yeah, I'm a featured teller this year. And then I also emceed 1 year and did their whole ghost story gazebo thing at night. Like, it's like about 1,000
the ghost stories.
Yeah,
the ghost story thing is fantastic.
The Ballad of Ronnie Callaway was done at the Midnight Cabaret. And then I was featured once before. So in the last 5 years, I've been there about 4 times. And I've been really honored. It's kind of...
Well, it's definitely... definitely an event that people need to go to. So, but here's my question. I mean, obviously I went because I'm a novelist and I love to hear stories, but what do you think is the attraction of all these storytellers, you know, and what makes it so fascinating for people to attend? And how do you hold an audience's attention through one of these ballads that are a couple hours long?
Well, the Ballad of Ronnie Callaway was an hour and a half, but most of the time there's 6 tents. They seat about 1,500 a piece. I think there's one that seats 850, but the rest are like 1,500 to 2,000, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they switch them out. Like, there's an hour set, and one teller has one 30-minute set, and the other one has another 30. So it's kind of moving, so that helps a little bit. It's like a spa for the soul. That's the only way I can explain going to that festival. There are festivals, no matter where you live, if you put in storytelling in the state name, there's festivals everywhere, and I know that because I work them. I'm going to lacrosse this week. I was in North Carolina a week ago, you know, on and on and on. It's shocking how much storytelling stuff there is. But there's one in Utah, and it's called the Timpanogos Festival, and if it's as big easily as the national festival. But the national festival is where all storytellers want to get on stage. It's kind of like You know, I'm sure there's a national literary conference where every author who is anybody is there, plus up-and-comers are dying to get on that stage because it means you made it. And it's kind of like the National Festival does that for us. And the audiences there are superb. They come to listen, and it's just juicy.
That's cool. Yeah. So do you think an author – oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the interesting things, Kim, that you were talking so much about was knowing your audience and seeing somebody kind of bomb when they actually walked on stage and then the people's impression was negative in a certain way. And I was at the festival a number of years ago, and so Bill Lepp performed, and I know you've done some shows with him over, you know, some tours and so on like that. And people loved it, and they had a great time and stuff. Then another performer came on who did more children's material, and he came on and started to do this children's material where he had all these different characters and kind of physical humor falling down, sound effects and stuff, and it was just like dead. Because it wasn't – I mean, most of the people at this festival and that in that tent at that time were probably – half of them were retired, and the rest were – all adults, and he just didn't connect with his audience, and it kind of bombed, even though he's a, you know, a great storyteller, and had he had 1,000 kids there, they'd have been going crazy.
Right, great story, wrong time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, so I think, you know, also, what else can happen sometimes, Stephen, is the person before you wears them out. And Bill, because I tour with Bill every – we've toured together 7 years, Andy Alfred Irwin and myself and Bill. And we're doing our – this will be our seventh year, sixth year for Christmas tour, but 7, 8 years together. But because Bill does Tall Tales humor, he's been on Comedy Central. I mean, not on – he performed in the Comedy Central Theater. I mean, he's really just laugh. If you follow him, you had better have some energy going because he wears them out. They're tired. After 30 minutes with Bill, you're just exhausted because he's taking you on a mental ride and you've laughed so hard. It is a tough one to follow. Now, I can follow him with no problem, but I've learned what I need to do. And I don't get up and do some sappy, poignant piece, even though it's lovely, it's not the right time because they are so high, I can't bring them down. Or if I do, it has to be really slow and gentle that they don't even realize it, and then I got to just still keep on really hopping. And that happens in oral telling. Sometimes the person in front of you just wears the audience out. But
do you remember Jackie Torrance?
I never got to hear her, but she is very well known, and yes, I know exactly who she is.
Yeah,
the
first festival I ever told stories at, I think this was in 96, I followed her on stage, and so I'd never been at this festival or not, but I actually preferred having someone who was really good before me, because, you know, people's expectations were, I loved it, but then other times you follow someone who's not that good, and I didn't enjoy that as much. I didn't like that.
Well, you got to work so hard to pick up the pieces.
Yeah.
I personally like my audience to have low expectations and have consumed alcohol. That's like the best audience in the world. But seriously, I actually prefer a good solid performer before me. It doesn't scare me at all. As a matter of fact, it's better because then the people are in a great place and I get to just move in, whereas if the prior performer was somewhat lacking for whatever reason, you have to kind of pick up the pieces and get that audience moving, and so you lose 5 minutes just trying to get them back. Is that what you're saying, Stephen?
Yeah, no, I totally, yeah, I think that's exactly true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What would you say are some of the key principles or moments that might translate from telling stories orally to written stories? We've spoken with a lot of different authors on here, and people talk about plot or character and all of this, but I was just curious from your background, I know you write as well as perform, kind of what is it that you look for in a story and say, this is going to really relate to people?
Oh, that's a tough one because there's so much. People are such intricate little pieces of.
I was at a conference and Greg Iles, he's the author, was speaking and he was saying that he kind of looks at it like, I don't know, everybody has sort of this limited number of gold nuggets, and the gold nuggets are always formed actually from going through difficult times. And he's like, we only have a certain number of those. Most of us, most mortals do. And then he's like, if I'm writing a novel and I can include maybe one of those in there, that's usually people will write to me from all over the world and say, oh man, when I hit page 300, that page was my favorite page or that paragraph. And he's like, it's always the same one. And so I was thinking about it. It's like we have these moments of shared experience, whether it's grief or feeling maybe trauma or being picked on as a kid, whatever these shared experiences are, a lot of the times the storytellers that I've heard, when they can tap into that shared experience and we identify with the teller going through those questions or struggles or temptations or difficulties, I think then we kind of connect with and we hear it as our story and not just their story.
Absolutely. There's a universal ground and a common recognition. And that's one of the things that I find so beautiful about writing is even if the character is going through something that I never have, if the emotions they are experiencing are something that I have experienced, I instantly tap in and feel empathy. And when I do that, I have now put myself inside of them. And that's what I think really helps carry the reader or the listener forward. Because when you empathize, what you're doing is basically saying, I'm feeling what's inside of you. So you're pretty much placing your brain and your emotions, attaching them to what that person's going through, even if you've not walked that exact story path or that exact experience. You know, so if there's a woman in a story who's broken, feels beat down and isolated, I may not have had the same circumstances cause that, but at one time or another, most men and women have felt isolated at least once in their life. They felt beaten down by someone, a boss, a spouse, life, a parent, you know, and we can, it's amazing to me, people say about technology just making people cold and hard, and there is a side to it that I know can be very dangerous if people, you know, but it amazes me how quickly my audiences are quick to empathize and to attach themselves to the emotions in my story, thus they're in my story. And I don't think that changes from oral to written. You know, that just has to be constantly being pushed forward. And you know what else always, I mean, we know this, right? We know this. But what makes a good story is that someone's not getting what they want.
Yep.
Whatever that may be. Whatever that may be, whether it be peace, whether it be a material thing, whether it be the detective finding the killer, no matter what it is, it's somebody just not getting what they want, and we're on that with them, and we have to feel like we want it too. And that is what amazes me sometimes, how the readers or the listeners will side with the bad. They want the bad guy to succeed. It blows my mind how many books people want the bad guy to succeed in. And it's because you just want them to get what it is that they want. And it's carried forward by that constant suspense of, are they going to get it? Are they going to get it? Are they going to get it? You know, and there's multifacets to that with many people in the book striving to get what it is their goal is for that story. And that's a lot of fun.
That's great. I love that. Well, and I love how, you know, it really is that whole universal sense of, you know, find that emotion that everybody can relate to, that everybody understands, and then bring them forward through the story. And I love that whole idea of, you know, creating a character that we understand that doesn't get what he wants. And that's universal no matter what you're doing, storytelling, oral storytelling, or writing a novel, or, you know, whatever. So now, do you have some of your stories on CDs or DVDs?
Oh, yeah. I've had 9 CDs, but one was a limited edition and sold out. So I think I have 8 now, and one's out of print. So I'm just going through my head. So there's 7, I believe, and they're all have won awards. except the last one, which is gone up, so, because, you know, that's just how I roll. And that was a joke. You guys are, like, all quiet. I don't know if you caught what I said. But anyways,
oh, no.
Yeah, so they're out there, and you can get them on my website. And
yeah, tell us about your website, and because we want our listeners to go check out some of your stories.
Mm-hmm.
And some of your CDs, and you said you're doing a book, so that's fantastic. And
tell
us where to go and how to connect with you.
Okay. Well, KimWhiteCamp.com, and it's spelled weird. If you just put in Kim Whitecamp story, spelled any way you want, I'll come up, and you can find me that way. But I have a store on there where you can get things. But this October, one of the things I'm well known for are my original ghost stories. And this October, I'm offering a free download, so that'll be cool. And we're getting ready
mm-hmm.
to completely revamp the website, actually, and make digital downloads possible. But you can get my album straight from there, straight from the office here, and see what's happening. There's news and all that good stuff and some fun stuff on there and a little more about what I do and how I do it.
Yeah, and Kim performs all over the country, so no matter where you are listening, you know, check it out, and maybe you can catch her when she's in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, thanks for listening, and Kim, thanks so much for being here. I was taking notes, actually, as you were talking.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm. Me too.
It was great.
That's why we were so quiet. We're taking notes.
So info about my books and my speaking schedule is at stephenjames.net.
And you can find out information about me at SusanMayWarren.com or learn some story coaching at LearnHowToWriteANovel.com.
And for more info about our guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to the StoryBlender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.